Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Carey murdered a child.
The evidence and the counter-evidence, I'm struggling with that.
When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Still Watching The Outsider. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
This week we will be discussing episode 4, Que Viene El Coco. Only events from this episode will be in discussion. However, this is a show that is based on a novel by Stephen King. There are some differences from the book and the significant differences from the book and the episode this week. We will be discussing those departures. I don't consider that a spoiler. I won't be talking about anything that happens in the future. I just think it's worth noting some things that were added for the TV show, but I wanted to warn you guys, up at the top, cause we got a little bit of a salty, email about a spoiler, from our first episode, when I said Jason Bateman briefly stars, in the show. And whoops. I guess someone hadn't watched the episode yet. Anyway.
Well, hey, he's in this episode technically. So
that shaggy hair cannot be denied. So if you've never listened to an episode of Still Watching before, what we do is we pick a show, we watch it. We're watching The Outsider on HBO on Sunday nights. We break down the episode in question and we read your emails, and it's basically like a little TV club. That's what we do. We're a little TV club, discussing Stephen King and creepy child murder. It's fun times. So we are going to start first with some feedback from you all. We got some emails, and then also someone tweeted at us this morning. So I actually thought I'd start with this tweet, which comes from Alex Greenfield, at Alex D. Greenfield, who writes, listening to you still watching The Outsider with Joanna and Richard. Fascinating conversation regarding Holly. I'm disappointed the showrunner says he's ignoring the Hodges trilogy. That's the Mr. Mercedes stuff that I was talking about last week. In that both her ability to connect with others and awareness of supernatural are born there. When we meet her in Outsider, it is in the wake of losing her closest true friend. It's in and through her relationship with Ralph and the others that she rediscovers herself. Anyway, I want to geek out on King with Lawson and Robinson for hours. Great pod. So thank you, Alex. Thanks for that little compliment at the end.
Thanks for keeping the compliment in, Joanna. I appreciate it.
I just thought I'd read that. I just like it when people call me by my last name. That's the thing. I like it. It makes me feel like a Cub reporter. So, I thought I'd leave it in there. So I just think that's interesting. That's a little bit of context that we're missing. Probably it was not factored into this creation of Holly. And I believe that Cynthia Erivo also said that she hadn't read the book. So like she's not even using that to influence her performance. But I do think situationally, it's interesting to think about this character as someone who maybe has lost their main anchor. And that's something that she talks about in this episode with her relationship with her mother. We can get to that. But someone who's maybe lost a main relationship that anchors her and is sort of seeking it out in the form of this character of Ralph Anderson. Does that do anything for you, Richard?
Well, I mean, I think the only thing that I can kind of think of as to why, like, Richard Price, who's doing most of this adaptation, would choose to kind of not minimize Holly's kind of backstory or anything, but kind of ground it, is that like the whole arc of the show thus far seems to be about normal people realizing that something very unnormal is happening. And I think that if Holly's character had too much of a sort of backstory that seems that was kind of more in line with unnormal things, maybe the impact wouldn't be the same. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think I made a joking reference to like Mulder and Scully, and she's definitely like the one who's open to these things, whereas Ralph is like closed off. So that's definitely their difference. But you're right that if she's like, well, listen, you won't believe what happened to me last Tuesday, mm-hmm. is sort of like a different place to come at that from.
Yeah. So. And I think in the Mulder and Scully dynamic, which as much as it's there between her and Ralph, like, she's not a crackpot. You know, that's the thing, is like, I think that what's so great about her character in this episode in particular is just how sort of open and like attentive and she is, and like willing to like listen to people and sort of process that information and synthesize it later, you know? I like that she doesn't seem to have an agenda beyond like a curiosity.
Yeah. I agree. And then we got two pig related emails, and this seems to be our lot in life ever since Sharp Objects. So let's start with this one from Andy, which is titled Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue. I will leave the compliment out that starts this email. I have a theory that I'd like your feedback on. Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue seems to me to be symbolic of Terry's father's anger and violence issues, which were alluded to in episode 2. They were visiting his father, who lashed out at Terry. Big Daddy's hangry. And that's where the van started following Terry. I think that the evil itself emanates from Terry's dad, or at least has infected him for a long time and has been misunderstood in some way as dementia. Let me know your thoughts. I mean, we could talk about doing an event with you guys at the Paley Center one day. Oh, thanks, Andy. Oh, Andy works at the Paley Center. Oh, I didn't realize that. Thanks, Andy.
a little bit of career news smuggled in there.
That took a turn. I think this episode sort of disproves Andy's theory, but I love the reach for it. And I think, do you want to talk about this email at all? I think the next one sort of compliments it, but I want to make sure you get your daddy hangry thoughts in there.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that we're just keeping the memory of, you know, the hangry barbecue alive and well. I think that when looking at a King adaptation, again, let me stress for the fourth time in the fourth episode, I have never read a Stephen King novel, but I have seen many adaptations of his work. So forgive me if I'm assuming too much about Stephen King's work, but like, I think there's nothing wrong with assuming thematic allusions, tie-ins, and kind of everywhere you look, you know, whether or not it's going to kind of loom as a big part of the narrative, it might just be there as sort of interesting background texture.
Excellent. And then this one comes from Kate. It's called Hog Thoughts. she says, I had an observation about a scene in the first/second episode of The Outsider, and another random one about the cast that's neither here nor there, but gave me a little thrill. When we meet Jack Hoskins in the woods on his hog hunt, Jack Hoskins is who I've decided to refer to as Boil Neck, but you can call him whatever you want, Rash Neck. I don't know. But in my notes this week, he's just good old boil neck. So, this is our hangry, cop. So when we meet Jack Hoskins in the wood on his hog hunt, he gets a text to return to the office ASAP, but he hasn't fired any shots at the hog he's been hunting. However, after he leaves the woods, there's a cutaway shot to the body of the hog, and it very much looks like it's been mutilated, much like the body of Frankie Peterson was, rather than shot. This makes me think that the Dark Force slash Outsider has killed again and has Jack in its sight somehow, especially given his later encounter alone in the barn. Regardless of how the hog met its demise, it's great to see that hogs have become the unofficial mascot of the pod. I'm here for it. Thanks, Kate. And then Kate just notes that Yul Vasquez... she realized where she knew the actor Yul Vasquez from, that she knows him from Russian Doll, who, along with Jeremy Bob, who plays Alec Pelly, in this show, was also in Russian Doll. And so she's got all of her fingers crossed that Greta Lee from Russian Doll shows up in Outsider episode 6. So, yeah, here's for that Russian Doll connection. Something that I found out that I thought was interesting. Is that we already mentioned that, in an earlier episode, that the character of Holly Gibney, is maybe written as, or at least has been played as, white in other, adaptations. And we've got Cynthia Erivo, a black actress playing her here. And apparently that is, Richard Price said that is because Jason Bateman really wanted to cast Cynthia Erivo, specifically in this role. And Richard Price said he had written the character as Lithuanian American, but that Bateman had to have Erivo. And, I love that for Bateman. And I love that for Cynthia Erivo, that, Bateman's a huge fan of hers, as he should be.
And the Lithuanian got in there anyway.
Yes, it's true.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham. And this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Let us talk about Kate's emails. I mean, once again, I think this is close but slightly off, because I think we know who the Outsider's next victim is. We figured that out this week. But Jack is obviously like in his, like a thrall, like in his thrall sort of thing seems to be.
He's Renfield.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of eating bugs, he's like shopping at Target. Which this might be a good excuse for us just to talk, about what, Jack, aka Boyle Neck, is up to this week, which is like he goes to Target, he's being weird at work, and then he dumps everything he buys from Target or some sort of hardware store, Home Depot, whatever, including a lot of lamps, in the woods near a mutilated deer corpse, and he was seen dragging the deer corpse earlier. I think that's the full extent of his journeys in this episode. Any thoughts on that? On why the lamps in the woods?
I'm very confused about that. So we see this mutilated deer, much like we saw a mutilated feral hog earlier in the season.
Right.
And he's set up, it's not like he set up a room out in the woods. There is a lamp kind of standing up, but like otherwise it just seems like kind of like random stuff. And I'm just wondering, is it some sort of like modern sacrificial altar? Like, I'm just not really, I don't know. That was a confusing bit. I mean, this whole episode introduces a lot of things that for a while you were like, huh? And then it comes together, but I feel like that was the one that didn't.
Yeah, that's the one where we're going to have to wait and see why lamps in the woods. Like, there's a sleeping bag, too, and a few other things. And maybe that little clearing in the woods is close enough to an outlet that he could, like, hook those lamps up or a generator. I don't know. But the lamps in the woods, because it's not just, like, the big lamp. There's also, like, a little Pixar lamp. Like, it's mm-hmm. very, it's very confusing. So we'll see what happens in the woods. But that is what Jack is up to in this episode. A lot of this episode is about Holly, and I want to get to that and all of her discoveries as well. But I want to talk about this revelation. I guess I had missed the fact that the character that Patty Considine is playing, Claude Bolton, who's the manager of the strip club, got a scratch mm-hmm. on his hand. So, which feels very much, given what we understand of how this evil moves, means he's next, which helps us understand why this actor, who of such great caliber, has been cast in this seemingly peripheral role. Does that
Something is it's funny, I had seen this episode before a few weeks ago because I reviewed the show, but I guess I'd forgotten that or something, like, or missed it, like, I don't know. I think that this episode in particular offers so much new information that I guess I had sort of forgotten that particular tidbit. So, it helps give what we've seen so far and a better sense of shape, which I appreciate.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I don't blame you. I've done that before myself. You know, you get like 5 episodes of screeners. You have to like review something or whatever, and you sort of watch them all at once, and it's easy to miss smaller details. And then when you slow down and talk about something week to week and podcast about it week to week, you're like more on the alert, for details. So I do not blame you, for missing this or forgetting this. But yeah, it looks like we know. It's funny because this episode sees Holly trace, you know, the journey of this evil backwards. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but like, I kind of want to see, I'm like, and who scratched her and who scratched him? And like, how far back does it go? But we're probably going to follow this thing forward because a character we know, has been scratched next. So, we'll see where it goes from there. But the way we understand the journey is that this woman, Maria, who we meet in Rikers, got scratched and doppelganged. That doppelganger scratched Heath, and his doppelganger scratched Terry, and Terry's doppelganger scratched Claude. So that's the journey of the scratching and the evil. And we'll see what Claude does next. One thing that's very smart about this evil entity as it moves around is that it is spreading itself out, right? Like, mm-hmm. We're bopping around states so that it's not like all concentrated in one area. But one thing I was really gratified to have confirmed in this episode is something that we've been talking about, which is this thing where like this figure, this outsider who scratches people, doppelgangs them, and then kills children, doesn't just kill children, but, spreads that, evil to the family in terms of, either both the family of the victim and the family of the person wrongfully accused, wind up like dying or killing themselves or killing each other or whatever in these horrible, gruesome ways, which we see play out in both Maria's family and Heath's family. What did you think of that notion in this episode?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we see so much more clearly some of this entity's MO. I think, you know, I think actually interestingly in terms of it clearly has this survival mechanism in place, which is like to keep moving. So nothing is too concentrated, which then makes you wonder, well, then why is he or why is it transferring, you know, to someone else who lives in the same town as Terry Maitland, you know? So I'll be curious to see how that shakes out. But I liked what this episode did in the more macro sense of talking about that kind of grief eating and this really menacing force that might literally in a physical sense feed on the bodies of children, but then in a more abstract sense gets something else from, I don't know, whatever is given off by these ripples of grief and death and everything like that. And I like in a sort of thematic, like a kind of more allegorical way that it is, it's in some ways about people trying to comprehend, linked tragedy, you know, which that does happen, you know, that happens right. in the real world. And I think right. that like, I'll be curious to see, like, I mean, obviously it's Stephen King, so he's probably going to go pretty literal on the supernatural. I mean, it's already kind of in the series, but like, but I mean, there's like forensics in terms of this being, but like, I'll be curious to see like where the kind of thematic, more, again, more allegorical thing kind of ties in. Because I feel like it could be heading to something kind of moving and really, really satisfying.
Yeah, and especially since we have this character of Ralph Anderson who has not related to the entity as far as we know, his own like grief that's haunting his family, right? So I just think that that's interesting. Okay, so one other quick email that we got a couple days ago from Kyle, and he writes to say, want to mention that I don't think King is getting enough credit for the things you're liking about the show. You're giving that credit to Richard Price. The show so far is a very faithful adaptation, and the things you're enjoying, such as the relationship between Gloria and Jeannie, is all text in the books. And then he says, like, thanks for doing a King show. And Richard and I, both not as King experts and not having read the source material, I welcome, corrections about assumptions we're making about adaptation. We are going to talk about some things that I believe depart from the books, in this episode, but that's nice to know. I did make the assumption that that had been added in for this, and it's nice to know that that stuff is in the books. This, you know, speaking of that, like, widespread grief eating effect. I think it's not nice, but it's interesting to see. We see how it affects these various families. We've seen how it affects, fake Terry Maitland's victim, but, to see it, sort of bubble up against Glory in this episode when she tries to eat in the restaurant, I thought was like a pretty, I thought it was pretty like subtle, version of watching the things that she's having to grapple with and go through, and how that might be feeding this entity that feeds on grief and the aftermath of a tragedy like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do sort of, I think that what's interesting about Glory thus far is that while clearly reeling from all of this, from her kids getting expelled from their school to being accosted at, you know, just trying to have a quiet dinner, like in a really, you know, kind of menacing way, that she seems to have a good deal of metal to her and a sort of, you know, a toughness to her, which is not to imply that anyone who succumbed to this thing, this force, was not a strong person or whatever, but like,
right.
I think it'll be interesting if we keep with Julianne Nicholson's character to see how over time she kind of comes to stand up, in opposition to this thing, you know, or if she does.
Right. If she succumbs or if she survives. I do want to say my main critique of this episode, and it has to do with my personal frustration with the way that journalists are sometimes depicted in film and television. Richard, tell me if you have ever met a journalist who would fake three letters of recommendation in order to pretend to be a homeschooler in order to try to like get a story about a woman and her children.
Yeah, I don't really know what that was all about, because like on the one hand, I guess it was important to show that like people feel this incredible, like galling sense of like, they can just like insert themselves into her life whenever, because it's a tragedy to be, you know, mined or exploited or whatever. Like, I think that that's I think that for people who become, you know, dwell on in the, you know, under the scrutiny of the public eye, like that's something they have to deal with. But I just didn't understand what the end game, what there was. Like, at what point was this person going to be like, oh, by the way, I'm actually a journalist who's trying to write a sympathetic piece right. about you. Like, it just seemed like if the whole thing is predicated on such a lie like that, like, considering her children were expelled from school and she's trying to find them a home tutor or whatever, to kind of do that as like a disguise and then later at some unknown point, like reveal all and have that be okay. Like that seemed like poor planning on this, I guess, would be journalist part.
Yeah, absolutely. I was like, what are you even like? And then if she did get, if she never revealed herself and did get stuff on the record, by the way, because she had a tape recorder going, like she couldn't use that. Like what even, anyway, I just like, there are times when these depictions of journalists, and like Richard Price knows better, so I don't really know what's happening here, but I was just like, what even is this at all? Like, unless she's like a super trashy tabloid journalist, and I don't know any of those people. Like, I was just like, this is ridiculous.
They clearly exist. I mean, look at all the stuff in the UK with The Sun and Piers Morgan and all the wiretapping, yeah, grieving people. Like, I mean, there's definite precedent, you know, both here and abroad. I think in the wake of Richard Jewell, the movie with where Olivia Wilde's character plays a really nefarious journalist, it's a little bit, I think, more from a sort of like literary perspective. It's like, it's kind of a tired crutch to lean on to be like, oh, and everything's bad for them because everyone is prying into their lives. And you know, and here comes that in the form of like the sleazy journalist. You know, it just, it sometimes feels a little easy, I guess. And felt a little bit, I just feel like Glory would have been somehow more wary of this than to let that woman into her home, but I don't know.
Yeah, but she did, I mean, she was kind of onto her seemingly from the start, and then that woman couldn't do like basic division, which was confusing. So anyway, let's just, roll on.
I don't know that I could have done that, to be honest.
Am I allowed to use my phone calculator on this?
Right,
no?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So let's roll on to the meat of the episode, which is, Holly's investigation. So the thing that I keep talking about that is in the series that I believe is not in the book, though please, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I tried to look it up and I believe that this is true, is all the stuff with Maria and Holly going, like the character of Maria at all, Holly going to New York, all of that stuff, as far as I know, is not in the book. That, as far as I know, she traces the thing to Heath and doesn't like go back beyond that. But something that, Richard Price said in an interview that I was reading, with, the New York Post is he said, I followed the events of the book, but the issue was 10 hours of TV time. By the third hour, halfway through the book, I had 7 hours to go. So, you know, in order to turn this Stephen King book into a mini series, he had to flesh it out, which means that Holly follows the investigation a bit further. And I think culturally, there are some good reasons for that, because this idea of El Coco, which we will talk about, is in the book, but does not, I don't believe, comes from anyone of like Cuban descent as the woman who was talking to Holly about it. So I think it's better to have this monologue come from a woman who has some connection to that culture, rather than someone else. So I think that was a smart adaptive choice there.
Yeah. And it was, it's, you know, it's Richard Price. It's not gonna, we're gonna end up in New York at some point.
Yeah. So if you don't go to Rikers, is it really a Richard Price book?
Yeah.
Let us talk about, how that relates to the opening of this episode, which you mentioned that there's like a few things in this episode that you're like, what am I watching? And then later it becomes clear. And the opening of this episode is one of those moments where you're like, we haven't even met the Maria character. So we were like, what am I watching exactly? What is this breakfast? Who are these? I mean, Heath's there, but like, you know, what am I watching here? And then like, but to see her face change, this actress, and let me look up her name, but like, to see that performance of like a very flirty, like whatever, happy breakfast. And then like the camera catches her face just like changing, and it is very unsettling. We find out later that that's because, you know, it's a doppelganger and not Maria herself. But like, what do you make of the use of that cold open and then sort of how it comes back around in the episode?
Yeah, I just like the way that this show thus far doesn't let us forget, like that little things like, you know, obviously Heath is going to be a major part of this, but like we're introduced to him in a similarly kind of, obtuse way where we're like, what is this jail stuff? Like, but then we have to remember him, and then we see him further back in time. And like, I love that, in this episode, the, receptionist at the nursing facility later on is like part of the narrative, because Holly kind of waits for her after work, you know? And like, I just like that, like the world of this show feels complete and everyone has a little role to play. So I like that aspect of it. I also love the reveal that this flashback we see at the beginning that I thought at the time was supposed to show now miserable characters in happier times, but in fact was only showing one person in happier times and the other was, you know, another thing. And I thought that was like well done. And really, you know, there wasn't a ton of indicating when, in the jail scene with Holly where, when she's like, no, I never, I'm, yeah, like, I guess he was like flirty, but I never ended up going. And then the story kind of moves on and you're like, oh, well, wait, that means that she was, you know, so I don't know. I think that information was with the exception of the weird thing in the woods with the deer and the furniture, I think that information was meted out very interestingly in this episode. And, you know, is it a narrative conceit that like a woman at one table over in the visitation room would overhear this and go so far as to give her address kind of subtly and tell her to come, this stranger to come to her home? Maybe. But like also maybe there's a kind of underground knowledge, you know, circuit of people who believe in this stuff and share it with each other and maybe even kind of subtly or passively in some ways keep track of it, just to kind of know where that energy, is at any given time. I don't know, but, I love the scene in the apartment where really the kind of creature feature thesis of the show is laid bare.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will get to that boogeyman in a second, I promise. But I do want to zoom back to like the first half of the episode, which sees Holly getting some information from a fellow, another detective. The character's name is Andy Katkavage, I think. I might have just completely butchered that. But he is like also Lithuanian. This is like the whole like Lithuanian connection that Richard Price wanted to do or whatever. But if she's getting information about the case that she needs, once again, I don't think this is in the book. Please, you read in and correct me, but I tried to like look for this character's name in any covers of the book and I couldn't find it. I should just buy a copy of the book. I apologize. I should do that. But like, I don't believe it's in the book, which means to me that Richard Price is like, okay, my character needs to get, she has like basically four people she needs information from in this episode, right? The receptionist from the hospital, Maria at Rikers, and then this like helpful eavesdropper in her apartment, right? And then this guy. And so she's like, he's like, how can I break this up so it's not just like Holly sits and listens four different times? And then he like adds this sort of like frisson of romance that I found very endearing and charming and like engrossing. And so you're getting exposition, but you're getting it in the packaging of like this possibly first date or whatever. And I don't know. I don't know if this is like lame and basic of me, but I found it very, very charming.
Yeah. And I like the way that this show, and I think, you know, this maybe credit to King as well, but also certainly to Price. I'm a little more familiar with his style, that, you know, this is a show about investigating horrible, horrible things that are more and more likely caused by something supernatural and unfathomably powerful. And yet it's a show that also allows for little human moments like him being like, oh, well, we didn't order. And she's like, I'm not hungry. And he's like, oh, kind of deflated. Well, do you want another Coke? And she's like, no. And then she's like, double whiskey with water back. And then he like lights up and he's like, oh, I guess I'll have the same too. I just love the way that the evening just kind of shifted for him and for her. And I think I liked watching her decide to let it shift that way, you know, to make it shift that way. I just thought that was very sweet and, you know, sort of, you know, made me think of moments in my own life when someone has surprised me and been like, no, let's stay out or let's, you know, I don't know. I like that scene quite a bit.
I don't know if this is like, lame or whatever, but I get like really excited anytime someone's like, well, not every single person. I'm sure there are people where I'm like, ooh, no, thank you. But when someone's just like, let's get another round. And you're like, okay. Totally. Yeah, totally. Exactly.
It's such a great feeling. I mean, not all the time, obviously, but like once in a while when someone surprises you and you're like, oh, cool. We're not going home, you know?
You want to talk to me for the time it takes you to drink a whole other drink? And that, she was like double whiskey water back. And I was like, that's the serious, I want to continue this evening, move. So yeah, I really liked it. All right, so the actress who's playing Maria is Diani Rodriguez, and I thought she was great. And that, the whole stuff with her, you know, we got it with Terry when he was in prison. we didn't really like meet Heath that much. Like, he was pretty quiet in the times that we met him in prison. But like, to watch her and her anger and her frustration at being like falsely accused, like, you really understand why this is a project that Richard Price thought was interesting, because it's like, you know, this is the premise of The Night Of, right? Which is like, you know, false imprisonment or whatever. So it's like the frustration and then the injustice of being falsely accused or falsely imprisoned, but make it spooky. And so I just really thought this stuff with her, and like, why is she alive? Because she refused to let her fellow inmates kill her, basically. Like, and I thought all of that was pretty well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so that brings us to the naming of the boogeyman in this episode, which is El Coco, or whoever you want to.
Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga. And this is interesting. Okay, so.
Stephen Miller.
Sorry. You caught me off guard there. All right, so okay, I'm going to say something, and it's going to sound like an insult, but I don't mean it that way, which is, this reminds me of episodes of, like, Charmed, or Supernatural, or X-Files, or, to use a more modern example, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, where, like, someone had a really fun time looking up, like, the Wendigo, or whatever, and is, like, has looked up a mythological creature, and been like, cool, this is going to be the episode where we explore this, like, mythological creature. So El Coco, if you don't know, is like an actual, like, Baba Yaga. It might sound a little bit more familiar to you, but this is like an actual, mythological, figure, child snatcher, child eater, shapeshifter. What I think is interesting is this is where I really want the King fans to, like, write in and correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is that usually King creates his own iconic or mythological boogeymen, you know what I mean? You've got, like, Riddle Flag, or, like, you know, there's just, like, there are boogeymen that I associate with Stephen King, and I don't know how much I've seen him, appropriate's the wrong word, but, you know, like, utilize something from mythology in this way. I like it. But I have some questions about it. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, we don't know what this thing is actually going to be. Maybe it's something similar to these myths, but not actually those myths, you know, or lore, or whatever you want to call them. I'm kind of like waiting to reserve judgment on that. But what I liked about the kind of end of the episode that relates to that, I promise, when Holly is in the tub, just doing some research about, you know, El Coco and various other, you know, iterations of this kind of, this myth, is that she looks at these pictures of teeth gnashing monsters and she seems alarmed, and the show's music kind of indicates that she's alarmed. But then there's this much plainer, subtler drawing of a hooded figure, you know, kind of just looking at children, and it's so much scarier than the big gnashing monsters. And so I like that the show, and to me anyway, was sort of restating or stating anew its kind of like aesthetic thesis, you know, which was like, I don't think we're gonna get into a real like literal like creature monster thing. It's gonna, the scarier thing is if it's just one thing removed from being human, you know, that its face is messy, as you know, Terry and Gloria's daughter put it.
I love that. Cause that's something that I've been worried about. Cause like, I think that Stephen King, is strongest when he gives us horror that, as you say, is like one step removed from like ruining circus clowns forever, or, you know, whatever it is, or his villains that like have a very, have very mundane names, like, Annie Wilkes, the Fan, who's like, you know, or Randall Flagg, who's like the devil, but like Randall Flagg is such like a normal name, or like Percy from the Green Mile or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, there are these like, that King, I find the scariest and the most interesting. And then, when you have, like, you have to literally fight a monster king, like, literally fight a monster. That's the king that doesn't always super work well for me. So I'll be curious to see where they go with all of that. I did want to talk about the paintings. Okay. So one of the paintings that she looks at is Saturn devouring his son by Goya. That's a painting that I like recognize. And I was like, it was so funny. I had such a really lame snobby moment where I was like, does that really fit? Cause that's mythology. I don't know if that really fits. And then they like showed the title. I was like, someone messed up and put that in there. And then they showed the title. I was like, oh, never mind. And then I felt even more stupid because that painting that you mentioned, the one with the hooded figure, is also a Goya. So she went from like Goya to Goya. Mm-hmm. And it is called, is titled, Que Viene el Coco, which is the name of the episode, and also a lyric from the song that the eavesdropping woman sings. So that's from 1799, painted by Goya, Que Viene el Coco, and it is terrifying. You're right. All, like, just the hooded, gathered fabric around this figure, and you don't see the face, just the terror of the children and the anguish of the mom. And yeah. It's great stuff. Really, really good.
Yeah, and Saturn devouring his child, is kind of a go-to joke thing. I oftentimes am like, oh, I took a selfie, and then I post that.
Yeah, I've seen you use that.
because it's such a horrifying painting, and I think that something that is particularly horrifying about it is the look of almost surprise in Saturn's face and a little bit of like horror at what he's doing. Do you know what I mean? But there is that kind of still that kind of animalistic need to feed. And I think that clearly speaks well to what, you know, the entity that we're kind of circling around here, is driven by. Because like, why wear a hood? A hood presumes a little bit of shame in a way. Yes, because they want to hide in plain sight and no one can see their messed up face, but also there's a sense of lurking, of observation. And if you want to eat a child, if you want to watch their family, you know, crumble in concentric circles out and out and out, doesn't that suggest a certain maybe envy? An anger toward them because of something they have that you don't, you know, that this entity doesn't. So I don't know. I like the, what that kind of all implies that this, and it makes it scarier. If it's not just a monolithic totem of evil, but if it's actually something that has a little bit of pathos to it, maybe like that, I feel like that makes it, scarier, just like that painting.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And like this idea of a creature that's not just like a grief eater, but like a happiness eater, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, devours your happiness, destroys your happiness, and then eats up the grief, as well as dessert, as this woman, puts it. So yeah, the thing that I like that, this episode does, because I think there can be some like eye rolling stereotypes when you have someone be like, let me tell you the folklore of my people. And you're like, okay. But what I like is that Holly has her own sort of folkloric, tradition. And we've seen her, like, I really love the MRI scene, you know, where like she has this flashback to an MRI, you know, one of the many tests that she had to undergo as a child because she was so strange. And, strange is not probably the word I want, but like, all these tests that she underwent as a child, and that like, she had a vision, I think, of her grandmother giving her this like totem that would protect her. And she's reminded of it by seeing this other totem that's hanging from, the rear view of her cab. And we've seen her put out various totems, like when she goes somewhere. So like this idea that she has such an interest and connection to folklore, and that El Coco or Baba Yaga or whatever is a notion that's so petrifyingly strong that it transcends culture, and it is just something that has existed in if you go to it was kind of fun, I spent some time on it earlier, but if you go to the Wikipedia entry for the Boogeyman, which has that Que Viene el Coco painting as the like thumbnail on the Boogeyman Wikipedia page, there's just 100 entries from every country and what their version of the boogeyman is. And that's a fascinating and fun thing to look into. So,
and I love the symbolism at the end of the episode of, you know, Holly kind of perched on this precipice of, all right, am I going to accept this? Is this what I'm looking for? Is this what's happening? And then plunging into it. You know, I mean, the last shot is her going under the water of the bathtub. And I think it's just her deciding like, okay, like we're going down the rabbit hole, you know? And I think it marks such a, it's a subtle visual cue in a way, but it marks such a kind of, direction shift for the show as a whole. I just think that these episodes, I think this is Andrew Bernstein directed this episode. I think they're very, there's times when it's a bit heavy and, you know, maybe even turgid, but like, I think in other ways they're very subtly directed and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the way the universe is expanding. I mean, we went to a whole nother state.
Yep.
But as you say, in reusing various side characters, it doesn't feel like, you know, loose or sloppy or shambling or like I can't track it. It all feels sort of woven and connected. The other thing that I want to, say is a departure from the book, but once again, please email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. If we're wrong about this, is as far as I can understand it, the way the thing is transferred in the book is a cut on the hand. And they've used the word cut a couple times. And it seems to be, you know, at least for Terry and for Claude on in and around the hand or the hand or the wrist or whatever. I like that they made it just scratching more than cutting. And so then I really like the fact that we get this like sex scene. She scratches up his back and that's the scratch. In this, instance, and it just feels more like primal and scary than just like a cut on the hand, a cut on the hand, a cut on the hand, a cut on the hand. It's like, you could get scratched anywhere, bud, and then your whole life's gonna get stolen. And so be on the lookout.
Yeah. And what does that mean? It means that this creature has to touch you. It has to connect with you. It has to in order to become you for a second and then ruin you, you know? Like, so again, I feel like there is maybe somewhere a yearning in this bad thing, you know, that we're supposed to be sympathetic to it, but that sort of, I don't know, frames it all just that much more creepily.
Absolutely. All right. Anything else? I mean, we met Peter Maitland in this episode. It wasn't quite what I was expecting it to be, though he does say at one point, like, he had you all fooled or something like that. You know what I mean? So there is some, like, clarity.
Yeah.
Like, clarity through dementia, which is, you know, a little bit of a trope, but I think done, you know, well, in this episode.
Yeah, it's an effective kind of chill, you know, creep, you know, chilling moment. You're like, ooh, yeah. Like what did he knew something, but couldn't express it. Yeah.
He says stuff that we can decide if it's relevant or not. He says four jacks, four queen, you know, there's some like ramblings from Peter Maitland that if we decide it's relevant to the mystery, we can, overanalyze. But I am always very worried about being wrong when the book exists out there that I haven't read. So, there's that. One other thing I did want to mention is I do love that, the receptionist the nurse, I don't know if she's a receptionist or a nurse, but the woman from the hospital, like just straight up pepper sprays Holly. Like, yeah. I thought that was a great moment that Holly is just like following her and then gets like fully pepper sprayed and has to like prove who she is before she gets help. So that was a good moment. And then the last thing I want to say is something that I really liked because I think both the woman who works for the hospital, and then later when they're talking about what happens to Heath's mom, I think they repeat the phrase like, sort of like, what is it? I didn't write it down, but it's something like, makes a mother proud or something like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. And it's, you hear it twice. And that almost seems like a, you know, one of those like, supernatural sort of incantation, get in your head, sort of like, look out for the repeated phrases of people who are like judging you and talking about you. And that's what works its way into their head and makes them, you know, drive their car into a telephone pole or shoot up a bar or whatever it is. I don't know. I find it very creepy and effective. So, yeah. Anything else? Anything you're looking forward to seeing now, given all the new information that we have now?
I'm looking forward to Holly presenting all of this to who are otherwise pretty, so it seems, or seemingly very skeptical, you know, small town law enforcement people. I'll be curious to see how that goes over.
I hope she was like, she was actually putting together a PowerPoint and she's going to be using all those Goya paintings as her slides when she presents. Yeah. What I will say is that, you know, so we are now officially, I believe, is it a 10 episode? I know I already asked that.
I think it's 10, yeah.
Okay. Then we're not halfway through. Okay. Well, next week we'll be halfway through. It's not the, you know, to Richard Price's point in that interview, I found the, where we are at the end of episode 4, like, I don't need this show to end in 2 more episodes. You know what I mean? I think I was worried that we'd only have like 6 episodes worth of, story. It remains to be seen if we actually have 6 more episodes of story after, this episode 4, but like, I think I was worried that we had too little story for the amount of episodes. So, but I'm feeling less worried about that after this episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, my guess would be that this becomes a quest story in that, you know, we identify the big bad and then we have to go get the big bad, you know? So maybe that's the back half. I don't know, but, that would be my guess.
Yeah. It's interesting because we already know who's next in Claude. So that's interesting, you know, like,
yeah.
So, and it not only we, but like, it seems like Ralph kind of knows, right? Like Ralph's already asking about the cut on his hand or wrist. So I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully 6 more, episodes, maybe many more dates for Holly and Andy. I'm really invested. And that's about all we have to say. Once again, please, if we got anything wrong about Stephen King, nobody, emailed us about, the very sensitive conversation I was trying to, tiptoe around last week. So hopefully that means we didn't say anything completely disastrous. Or if we did, maybe people just stop listening, but hopefully, that means we didn't. But if you have anything to say to us, please do email us, whether it's about pigs or not, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Until next week, Richard, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm in Utah at the moment for the Sundance Film Festival, but I think I have to rush home. I have all these original Goya paintings and I just want to go back to my house and cover them up because they're creeping me out. I just don't like the thought of them sort of staring out into the dark of my empty apartment. So I got to go do that. But if I have some time on the flight home, I'm going to be tweeting from Ryla's and, writing Sundance reviews from VF.com. Joanna, where will you be?
I really wish, I know you told me that, Park City, Utah isn't that cold right now, but like, I kind of wish I was in a very cold place so I could wear like gloves and hats and scarves at all times so no one could scratch me and infect me.
I am scratch proof at this point.
Yeah. I just want all the winter wear. So you can find me shopping for winter wear, tweeting at Joe Wrote This. You can, Richard and I both will, be talking about award season on the Little Gold Men podcast and, over on VF.com. So we will see you in who knows what state, in who knows what maximum security prison, next week on Still Watching The Outsider.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress.
Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
From PRX.